This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Kaufman. Today with our nutritionist in residence, Layla Newton. We're answering your questions. And first of all, I want to extend to our audience a very happy and healthy Thanksgiving, full of warmth and fellowship, friendship and respite.
Yes, yes. Ditto, Dr. Hoffman. Yeah. Well said.
So it's possible that during this kind of, you know, this weekend, which is kind of a, you know, it depends. You know, you might be, you know, shopping till you drop, you know, because it's Black Friday.
Yeah.
And you might be on a frenetic regimen.
Right.
Or alternatively, you may be kind of resting and recuperating from Thanksgiving.
Yes.
And cleaning up, catching up on stuff.
Black Friday has lost its novelty because everybody's shopping online.
Anyway.
Nobody's getting online at 4:30 in the morning. That's craziness. Have you done that? I've never done
tackling
that.
People.
Tackling.
Pushing people
it's
out of the way.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
I want that big screen TV, not you.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway.
So better you should do something healthy on your own behalf and listen to catch up on Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We've got some great ones. We have a really interesting one on a book called Whitewash, which is about glyphosate. I really want to get the word out about glyphosate and the potential harms associated with glyphosate. I know it's controversial, and we have some well-meaning listeners who are, you know, many, some of them are farmers, some are in agribusiness. They want to, they want to minimize the potential harms because they believe it's a boon to agriculture. But really, I think we've got to take stock on GMOs before we unleash this technology.
That's true.
Helter-skelter on our
people
populace.
Farmers are using Roundup as a desiccant.
Yeah. And
apparently this has been going on for a few decades.
And now there's Roundup resistance, and what the net result is, like the law of unintended consequences. It was like we have to use other things in conjunction with glyphosate now to keep the weeds down because the glyphosate's not suppressing the weeds. So you're ending up with more residue. And, you know, which is particularly concerning to me is the study which showed that organic foods do indeed reduce the risk of cancer, but not all cancers.
Yeah.
But in particular, a type of cancer called non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which really seems to be associated with chemical exposure in industrial workers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that's what those lawsuits are about. The lawsuits against Monsanto, now part of Bayer. There's thousands of lawsuits in the pipeline. We're going to talk about multi-million dollar settlements. And it's the preponderance of the cancers are non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Wow.
Rare forms that are very aggressive, hard to treat. It's a bad cancer.
Parkinson's is also said to be related to these toxic exposures.
Reproductive problems, infertility, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, concerns raised, and that's a good podcast to listen to over the holidays. So I hope that you catch up and listen. We'll get right to questions. Radioprogram at AOL.com is the destination for questions. So we have some good ones this week.
Yes. We've got one from Nancy. Could you tell me if my 66-year-old sister should be concerned with test results of elevated liver enzymes and also LDL?
The question that, you know, is embedded in that question is the doctor apparently wasn't concerned, right?
Well, we don't know if there was a doctor involved.
Well, let's presume. These blood tests are generally ordered by a health practitioner. The health practitioner eyeballed the blood test and, you know, just sort of let it go. All too often, health practitioners, we have to say health practitioners these days because people who administer healthcare aren't necessarily MDs or DOs.
Yes.
They're going to be nurse practitioners, nurses, and
PAs
so on. And PAs,
yes.
Yeah. So, we'll just say, it's a little elevated, no problem.
Yeah.
And that may be because the person is cognizant of the fact that a person's taking a medication, such as a statin, which will raise liver function tests,
yeah.
and they'll go, no problem. Or, alternatively, there's a very high percentage of people, maybe 30, 40% of people, who have some form of liver abnormality that's due to fatty liver.
Mm-hmm.
And fatty liver will cause liver function tests to be a little high,
yes.
especially in overweight people with insulin resistance. And they'll go, I see that a lot. No
right.
big deal. Let's not worry.
It's like 40 or 45.
Maybe they'll do a test to make sure you don't have hepatitis C or something like that. Maybe they'll do a round of tests, but doctors tend to not be too proactive about it. I think they should be because it's something that should be addressed. It suggests that the liver is overworking and it could be a dietary cause. And it's so remediable.
We're seeing more NAFLD.
Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease.
Yes. So we're seeing a lot more of that.
Or you know, alternatively, they go, oh, maybe the person's drinking a little bit, you know, I'll ask them at the next visit, you know, cut back, you know, no, maybe those four beers you're having every night.
Yeah.
Not so good. The bottle of wine that you're having every night, with your spouse.
That's splitting
the bottle of wine. You know, you're a wine fancier. Cut it back.
That's still heavy drinking, at least in this country.
Right.
Not in Italy or in France, but in this country it
is. Right.
So Nancy's wondering, also she has elevated LDL, and she's wondering if it has any correlation with eating 4 organic eggs. Oh, no. She eats organic eggs every day, if that is a concern. No.
How many eggs?
She doesn't say. She eats organic eggs every day. So it depends
That would be me.
Yeah,
I mean, it's an emergency for me if I have less than a carton of...
Eggs and a pound of butter. And,
right,
yeah.
I got a little worried. You know, it's Thanksgiving and I'm going away for the weekend, but I'm down to 2 eggs.
Oh, no. When I left this morning, because I'm going away too,
that
when I come back, I still have about 7 or 8 eggs in the fridge. There's a pound of butter in the freezer.
I got to pick up
it's
some
all
eggs.
Good.
I got to pick up some... I don't think you can kill yourself with eggs.
No.
There may be some people rarely, you know, have a rare metabolic anomaly where they get something, you know, like very high cholesterol due to that. But they actually did a study.
Yeah.
I remember that study very well.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it was a study of a guy who was, he was schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
He was psychotic schizophrenia. And he had this thing about eating eggs. And he would eat enormous amounts of eggs.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even remember how many eggs he ate in a day. But he would, you know, have like enormous, you know, like 10, 12 eggs a day. And they wanted to study him because they said, this is interesting. You know, it's almost like it's a made for a study kind of situation. Because how can we get even an experimental volunteer to do this? They just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
We're going to study you. So we found, they did a bunch of blood tests, and they found that his enzymes for handling cholesterol were working overtime to eliminate the cholesterol from his body.
So it was up-ramped.
And his cholesterol was like 185. Enormous consumption of cholesterol. So
there you go.
It really, what it demonstrated is that people have the ability in a thermostat-like way to self-regulate their cholesterol that's not so dependent on diet.
Yeah, and you know, the manufacture of cholesterol by the liver operates on a negative feedback loop. So when we're getting dietary cholesterol, like from eggs, shrimp, butter, meat, the liver churns out less.
Yeah, so it's a negative feedback, just like your thermostat. You know, when the temperature reaches a certain level, I mean, if you put a space heater in your house, your furnace will turn off because it doesn't need to provide the heat anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So liver function tests should be looked at, Nancy. The LDL, I don't know. So probably less so. But thank you very much for this question.
By the way, did we miss something? Did she say the LDL was very high as a result of this?
She said elevated, but she doesn't give a...
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
Elevated LDL is, it traditionally, and in a kind of a paint-by-numbers script way, forces doctors to lower the LDL.
Yeah.
So, you know, the old guideline, and they've evolved past that. They now look at more at composite of risk factors. But they used to say, you know, your LDL should be under 130.
Yeah.
Or if you have cardiovascular risk, under 100.
Yeah.
Or if you've had a heart attack or stroke or bypass,
less than 70.
You know, there's like these numbers that are arbitrary. But what we do when we evaluate a patient, we just saw a patient who has LDL over 200, and we did an EBT heart scan. She has zero plaque. Mm-hmm. Her cholesterol is over 300 routinely.
Yeah.
And for some reason, she's protected against cardiovascular disease. The quality of the LDL matters. We measure the particle size. We measure whether it's oxidized.
Yes.
We look at other cofactors. Is the patient lean? Is the patient exercising? Is the patient not hypertensive? Does it's a homocysteine high, LP little a, C-reactive protein is very important because
very
inflammation
important.
Will,
important.
Along with LDL, create risk.
There was a nice summary on SpectraCell of a study that said that LP little a is a much more important risk factor.
Unfortunately, we don't
LDL.
Have that much to do about LPA.
Yeah,
it's kind of
hard
to lower.
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
So, okay. Great. Nancy, thank you for your question. This is from Jean. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, this item popped into my Google News feed and I found it quite amazing. Not sure what it means other than there is so much modern medicine does not know. Do gut bacteria make a second home in our brains?
So tell us about that story.
Yeah. What they found, this was at the Society of Neuroscience, a recent meeting, and what they found, and this work was done on cadavers, they found that gut bacteria had migrated to the brain. When they actually sequenced it, the RNA sequencing revealed that most of the bacteria were from three phyla common to the gut. Firmicutes.
And they were in the brain.
In the brain, that were in the brain.
So that means when you call somebody a crap head, they actually are? Whoa.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. When you have.
We already
exactly.
know that it's not so
crap
bad to call
brains.
Somebody.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. We already know that calling somebody a fat head, that's not bad because all those omega-3 fatty acids are beneficial for brain functioning. Okay, well, let's talk about that. That's weird because, I mean, traditionally, it was thought that if you have bacteria in your central nervous system, that's like really bad. That's a systemic infection. It's a bloodborne infection.
Yeah.
And you're teetering on the brink of annihilation. It's like a medical emergency and you need to be on intravenous antibiotics.
Here's the confounder with what they found here is this work was done on cadavers, on dead bodies, and there was no certainty that they were not compromised.
So what happened? There is this thing called the blood-brain barrier, and it's active when you're alive, and it may cease to be active when you die. So therefore, the bacteria may translocate from the intestine into the bloodstream, and then hence travel to the brain. So this finding, do they comment on this? Do they say it's consequential in some way?
It could be, but even if the bacteria were never really thriving in the brains, the patterns of their post-mortem invasion are intriguing.
Okay, intriguing. Thank you.
Yeah.
But here's what is true, is the bacteria in your intestine, even when they remain in your intestine, affect your brain big time.
Absolutely.
Because we know there's a link between dysbiosis and anxiety, depression, inflammation, which is, you know, affects the brain, makes you feel crappy, you know, and so on.
Right. That's
it's big.
True.
And neurotransmitters too.
So much are made in the gut. 90% of serotonin is made in the gut. If you don't have the right microbiota in the gut, you may be anxious, depressed, or anything else.
And they have an impact also on the vagus nerve. Which I don't have the vaguest idea what it does, or we don't, but it's the biggest nerve in the body, and it's like the Long Island Expressway from the gastrointestinal tract to the brain and back. You know, it's a two-way superhighway of signals.
That's true.
The brain definitely affects the gut. I mean, people have diarrhea sometimes before a big test or interview.
Exactly. And or going on stage or something like that. Yeah.
Alternatively, if you have SIBO, bacterial overgrowth, you may have brain fog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you may have brain fog. It's true. So this is very interesting. Jean, thank you for sending this to us. Apparently more research needs to be done here, but we know that there is a gut-brain connection, so it's not too far off the mark. They even found in inflammation of the brain, because very little will the blood-brain barrier is very, very, it's almost... You don't want to say not permeable. It has to be. But they found some inflammatory cytokines in the setting of lupus.
Okay.
that have crossed the blood-brain barrier and have shown to cause depression or
very common to see psychiatric problems in patients with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, often depression, because their brains are inflamed.
Their brains are inflamed. I think, first of all, they're depressed because of their medical condition.
Well, that in itself. It's not just that. I mean, I feel depressed if I have, you know, an ingrown toenail. Mm. You know, I'm very...
Ouch.
Yeah. But it's not going to send cytokines into my brain directly causing inflammation.
Yeah.
You know, so look, I mean, there's this whole illness predicament that can depress people. I get it. But there's actually... The illness itself may influence the brain because... The brain, unfortunately, sits atop the body. It's part of our body.
That's right.
It's not separate.
It's holistic.
Yep.
We are holistic. Okay. We've got another one from, let's see here. Who sent this to us? I don't have a name, but have listened to you, Dr. H, for decades. I have an A1C of 5.4, but my fasting glucose is about 100.
By the way, that's good for our, you know, for listeners. Anything below 5.6 is normal, non-diabetic.
Yeah.
And 5.4 is even better.
Yeah. This person is concerned about the studies that say that diabetics benefit from eating fewer animal products, leaning towards a more vegetarian or vegan-based diet plan. So new analysis finds more benefits of a plant-based diet. But this person is saying, how do I do this? I've been eating low carb. So this is actually helpful for me to do this. But even when I have carbs at dinner, it raises my morning blood sugar, which we have to say, by the way, is not too bad for this person. Well, it's a fasting
what was it?
At 100 to 115 in the
She's finger sticking.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad idea. You know, people can learn a lot about how they react to foods and diet and exercise by finger sticking, even if they're not diabetic.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a little OCD sometimes to do that, but it's actually useful, especially in pregnancy.
Yeah.
You know, or when you're embarking on a new program and you want to find out what foods influence you.
Yeah.
So let's speak to that. First of all, you know, we've got to say in general, nutrition studies are rife with bias.
That's
and you
true.
Have to kind of see where the researcher's coming from. Do they have an axe to grind?
Yeah.
Are they proponents of a vegan or vegetarian diet?
Yeah.
And they're trying to demonstrate that.
Right.
And they can because some studies marshal all the evidence that supports that.
Two potential flaws here.
Sure.
And one of them is a more plant-based diet, more vegetables, more fruits, maybe whole grains, legumes, all of that. Of course, that is way better if you've been on a pizza, french fries, and bucket of flan diet for most of your
sad
life.
Sad diet.
Of course that's going to be
standard American diet.
Better
so moving,
than what you were doing.
Moving from a standard American diet of junk food, fast food, you know, poor quality animal protein, to a vegetarian diet is probably beneficial and will help a lot of people.
And the other assertion they make here, which I take issue with, there is scientific evidence that eating large quantities of red meat increases the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. When they talk about those eating that large quantity of meat, they're talking about the bacon cheeseburger with french fries and the soda that they're having.
Because most epidemiological studies, when they look at people who consume a lot of meat, they also consume a lot of other stuff. They're not looking at a community of the keto community.
They're not.
Of, you know, people eating, or the paleo community, people eating grass-fed animal protein, carefully prepared to the exclusion of junk and poor quality oils.
Exactly.
And so, you know, looking at epidemiological studies, generally meat eating is associated with indiscriminate diet and vegetarian is associated with careful diet.
Yeah.
And also vegetarianism is also, how many people who eat a really high meat diet are practicing yoga scrupulously, doing meditation?
That's true too.
You know, doing all those kinds of things.
Yeah, I have to say, I took yoga in college and textbooks and all of this, and I remember reading Sivananda and all of this kind of thing. Here's where yoga and I part company.
Right.
Is in that philosophy of, we are meant to be more vegetarian, vegan. This is how your body wants to eat. It doesn't want to eat this meat. It doesn't want to. And that's really where I parted company with yoga. Although I'm a yoga practitioner.
It's from
myself.
India.
I love it.
They're Hindus. They don't eat beef.
Vegetarian.
You know?
Exactly.
Right. And there's a big tradition of vegetarianism. And also there's a tradition of ahimsa, which is not harming animals. You know, like the people who, the Jains in India, who don't even want to step on an ant inadvertently, you know.
Yeah.
So they're it's a it it's philosophical rather than a scientific nutrition thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, having recently attended a conference on nutrigenomics, which is studying the variations that people have in their genes and how they express their genes, it may be that certain people don't do well on animal protein and might do better on a vegetarian diet based on a genetic predisposition. Mm-hmm. How you can go wrong with that is by following a high protein diet and, you know, you're trying to be low carb and high protein, but you're not having enough fat.
Yes.
So what, you explain what happens
now. Yes, what happens there is there's a such thing as too much protein. That excess protein turns into blood sugar, almost as if you were eating carbohydrates. So
in fact,
you have
it's got
to
a,
be careful.
There's a word. It's like in the Bible.
Gluconeogenesis.
In other words, glucose, new genesis.
Yeah.
From protein. It's like magic. The body takes the protein and converts it. So if you limit the protein, you won't get as much gluconeogenesis.
Right.
You'll get your fuel from fat.
Yes.
And people are fat phobic. So there's a lot of people who, you know, like, for example, South Beach diet. South Beach diet has taken the Atkins paradigm.
Yes.
But they said, well, the problem with Atkins, he tells you you'll eat too much fat. We know fat's bad for you. So eat a lot of protein, very lean protein, and cut your carbs. All that protein, and you're not going to get as much blood sugar reduction as if
it's
you
true.
Take some of that protein, reduce it, and have some fat as fuel.
Exactly. Exactly. And a lot of people don't. Many proponents of low-carb diets who do it the wrong way insist it's a high-protein diet. It's not. It's a higher-fat diet. It's about 60%
and
fat.
In addition,
to start.
It needs to be whatever you're doing, high fiber, high prebiotic content.
Yes, you're getting plenty of vegetables and fiber. You're getting some fruit, especially in the form of
that
avocado.
That supports the microbiome, which influences glucose metabolism and insulin resistance. Because if you don't have the prebiotics to have a healthy microbiome and healthy flora, you will have a propensity to obesity no matter what.
That's true. That's true. And later on, when they do an autopsy, they may find that in your brain, microbiota.
We just keep coming. We're just fascinated by that.
That's really interesting.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. So I would say to you, keep eating low carb the way you are. A lot of these studies, there are confounders here. You know, they're looking at certain populations of people who eat red meat as the big sandwich eaters and the burgers and fries eaters. They don't take into account the other junk food, as you mentioned earlier, Dr. Hoffman, that's included there. And they need to make that distinction.
Yep.
They don't. So, okay. Oh, I have a very nice comment here from Dom. Layla, my father, who is now 90, is still avoiding dialysis thanks to your diet consultation a year ago.
Great. He's only got about 10, 20 years to go, and he'll be home free.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me know that, Dom. And best regards, warmest regards to your father. Wishing him continued health.
That's great. And, you know, again, because dialysis is arduous and stressful and could really accelerate the demise of a fragile older person. So the extent, you know, that he can, you know, hold that off will be advantageous. I mean, a younger person, you know, dialysis would free them
that's true.
And really help them. But got to be careful. Okay, so,
by
the way, really good podcast recently about nutrition for renal disease. Mm-hmm. We talked to a doctor who herself has renal disease, has had dialysis, had transplantation, undergone that whole process, but she has tremendous insights on what to eat.
Doctor,
and what
heal
supplements
thyself.
To, yeah.
Oh, I have to listen to that. That's okay.
That's a good one. I think you're, because she's seeing one of our patients and that I ended up interviewing her. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, great. Let's pause because we divide the podcast into two parts. Give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
Does taking NAC on an empty stomach followed by a coffee enema increase the glutathione in my body?
Wow. Okay. We're talking about a self-hack with coffee enema and glutathione. Let's tackle that. That'll make your job, make you better at your job in Silicon Valley, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is our weekly Q&A with Layla, part of our Intelligent Medicine series.